Christian Philosophy, written by Joseph M. Dettor, read by Joseph Freundorfer, with permission from Sinoctala Publishers. Part 7, History of Philosophy. Chapter 44, Introduction to the History of Philosophy. Section A, Philosophy as Instrument of Theology. The last section of this book on Christian philosophy is a brief reflection on the relevance of the history of philosophy for theology. Let us recall that reason is to faith what philosophy is to theology. See Chapter 2, Section C. The believer looks at reality in the light of his faith, but in so doing, he uses his reason. It is therefore of interest to the theologian to know what reason can know without the light of faith by studying the history of philosophy, both 1. Outside the faith, and 2. In opposition to the faith. In the latter case, to realize how easily reason goes astray when it withdraws from the guidance of the light of the faith, and, in the former case, to realize how indeed the faith has come to perfect the best achievements of reason. For a Christian, the standard to evaluate a philosophy is the truth, equals agreement of the mind with reality. As above, all cultural and subjective differences, and as guaranteed by the teaching authority, magisterium, of the Church, see Chapter 2, Section B, which makes our conviction more firm than any natural certainty, since we trust God then, rather than man, see Chapter 28, Section C. It is not a matter of seeing only the errors, or only the truth, or of developing a childish admiration for the philosophers. The primary interest of a Christian in the history of ideas must be their relevance to the Christian faith. When he reads philosophy, he should not take an emotional approach which might lead him to compromise with error out of personal sympathy with the philosopher. He must always hold on to the truth and to what other helps in the salvation of souls. If a philosophy has done harm to the faith, it is not a matter of hating or condemning the philosopher, since only God can judge the persons, but one has to look at the objectivity of the data. One might be inclined to accept or compromise with some philosophy incompatible with the faith by suggesting some alterations here and there to make it compatible. But this is a high risk to take. Rather, if that philosophy did actually do harm to the faith, the adverse judgment, not of the person, but of the ideas, should be all the more severe. On the other hand, whatever truth there is in any philosophy is useful to theology, and therefore acceptable. This is how St. Thomas handled the Greek philosophers and the Muslim and the Jewish theologians, from whom he accepted a great deal. See Chapter 4, Section B. However, the case of modern philosophers is different. St. Thomas was able to take that liberal approach with non-Christian philosophers because they were really pre-Christian, while modern philosophy as a whole, see Chapter 4, Section C, has rejected Christianity, even though individual philosophers have remained Christian in an admirable, though doubtful, effort of assimilation. It would therefore be rash oversimplification to claim that, just as St. Thomas baptized Aristotle, we should now baptize modern philosophers. Some of them would in fact turn in their grave were we to attempt such a thing, as they are not just non-Christian, but post-Christian, or even anti-Christian. Modern philosophy is inextricably bound up with Christianity, to the extent that it simply cannot be understood without it. All that it affirms and all that it denies is part of the Christian heritage, either because it preserves it or because it rejects it, hence the need to study it. Section B, Overview of the History of Philosophy. We can divide the history of Western philosophy into three periods. See Chapter 4. First, pre-Christian philosophy, from about the 7th century BC into the Christian era. Second, Christian philosophy, up to the 15th century Renaissance, transition into. Third, modern philosophy, with the following cultural stages. Renaissance, shift of interest from God to man, Protestant, revolt 16th century, rationalism, 17th to 18th centuries, Romanticism, 19th century to our time. Let us now briefly point out the characteristics of each of these periods. First, pre-Christian philosophy extends well into the Christian era. A philosopher like Plotinus, for instance, is considered pre-Christian, even though he lived in the 3rd century AD, because he was never a Christian. Or take Averroes, for example. He was an Arab who lived in the 12th century after Christ, but he can also be considered a pre-Christian philosopher because he never had any real contact with Christianity, as he lived in a different cultural area. Culture has to be taken into account in assessing philosophy. Pre-Christian philosophy, then, includes the classical philosophy of Greece and Rome, which flourished from the 7th century BC to about the 5th century after Christ. Did these philosophers receive any influence from Christianity? Not up to the time of Christ, of course, but they did receive some influences from the Old Testament through the Jews, especially towards the end of this period. There is one particular philosopher who was a contemporary of Christ. He was Jewish and lived in Alexandria, Egypt. His name was Philo of Alexandria, and he was the first philosopher to attempt a synthesis of Platonism and the Bible, i.e., the Jewish Old Testament. The endeavors of these pre-Christian philosophers, such as those of Plato and Aristotle, are quite remarkable. They were just using their human reason without any divine revelation to guide them. Their sheer effort of reason is all the more remarkable and worth studying because it shows how far reason can reach by itself alone, as well as how many errors reason can fall into without the guidance of divine revelation. The second period is that of the Christian centuries, showing the power of divine revelation to inspire men in their search for truth. The metaphysical achievements, i.e., in the doctrine on God and man, of these centuries are unsurpassed. The wisdom accumulated in those centuries is incalculable. The problem is the time it would take to read the works therein produced, but anyone who really gets acquainted with that wisdom comes to that conclusion. Since usually there is little time for this, what is essential is to know very well the Catechism of Christian doctrine, which contains this wisdom in simple formulas. Those who believe in man more than in God try to bury that Christian wisdom of the past, to rule it out as out of date, not bothering to read it. Others, with blank minds, swallow this as the truth, so that in the end, almost nobody reads the treasures of Christian wisdom. The Christians themselves, because they don't have time, the enemies of Christianity, because they don't want to hear, and those who are neither enemies nor friends just follow whatever the others say. See chapter 1, section C. Now, the third period. What happened in the 15th century? In every century, many things happen, both good and bad. For one thing, the church has always managed to produce saints in every age. There is a steady flow of them throughout the centuries, so that the church always manages to save the day, to arrive on time with the appropriate men or women of God. But it is also true that every age has its share of calamities in every respect. Satan is never at rest. The Renaissance meant, first of all, a shift of interest from God to man. Recall the movement of humanism. There were many factors. One of them was the economic development of Europe, which was the occasion for an increase of greed, of selfish interest in man, in how to make man happy, making happiness an end in itself. See chapter 36, section D. This led to a tendency to regard God either as a stranger or an outright enemy to human happiness. Renaissance means revival. What did they revive? They claimed to revive the classical culture of the Greeks, not, however, with the approach of St. Thomas, i.e., trying to learn how far the Greeks had advanced in their search for truth, but with what they called the modern approach. In fact, they invented this word modern from the Latin modo, equaling now. The moderns were those who rejected the immediate past as a period of subservience of man to God, to revive the classical past for them was to return to the time when man was still in the forefront, and the gods were seen as accessories to human happiness. Their interest in the revival of pagan culture was to a large extent a reaction against God. It was then that Martin Luther, 1483 to 1546, changed the concept of religious faith by making God definitely an accessory to human happiness. His question was, "What good is God to me? It is I that is important, not God." And that is the essence of Protestantism. All external authorities are eliminated, and man is left alone before God, to use God for his own happiness. What use can I make of God? How happy can God make me feel? See chapter 4, section C. This was followed by rationalism, initiated by René Descartes, who lived in the first half of the 17th century. Rationalism is the reduction of everything to what is merely natural, i.e. within the scope of human reason, and the rejection of whatever is supernatural, i.e. above human nature and above human reason. See chapter 4, section C. And the latest cultural period is Romanticism, one of whose results has been the reduction of what is human to what is merely material by putting feelings above reason. This has led to an out-and-out materialism in the 20th century, the reduction of man to animal. Let us now take a closer look at those three periods, albeit in brief outline. Since a detailed history of philosophy is not within our scope,